makes life confusing.
Welcome to our panel on transnational anarchism in the Americas. Actually, our first panel on transnational anarchism in the Americas. Let me just go ahead and introduce our panel here from my left. On the stage right. Thank you. First of all, we have with us today, and I'll keep this brief, Kirk Schaefer, who is Associate Professor of Latin American Studies at Penn State University, Berks College. Kirk is the author of, among other things, Anarchism and Countercultural Politics in Early 20th Century Cuba, and several articles on anarchist culture and politics in Cuba and the Caribbean. And to his left is Kenyon Zimmer, who is Assistant Professor of History at the University of Texas at Arlington. Kenyon is currently in the process of transforming his dissertation, The Whole World is Our Country, Immigration and Anarchism, 1885 to 1940, into a full-length book. And his research interests, which I think he'll make clear today, concern Italian and Jewish anarchism within the context of migration and transnationalism. He's also editing an anthology, this is very cool, concerning the IWW and transnationalism with Peter Cole and Dave Struthers. And finally, Stephen Kirsch, Associate Professor in Latin American History at the University of Pittsburgh at Greensburg. He has written a history of, co-edited with Lucien Vanderwald, a volume entitled Anarchism and Syndicalism in the Colonial and Postcolonial World, which was put out by Brill. And Steve works broadly in the history of anarchism in South America, but more specifically in Peruvian, the history of Peruvian anarchism, which is very interesting. So, without further ado, I will.
Let's please make this a child-friendly space. There's a little person who's going to come in a little while.
What should we do?
Just be nice.
I didn't hear a cat at all. Keep it child-friendly.
So nothing.
Nice. Okay. And any other announcements?
I'm recording unless someone has a problem with that. And the question was asked in the other session, like, what are you recording for? Which I think is a very legitimate one. So we're recording maybe for the Media Co-op, maybe for Vancouver Co-op Radio, maybe for people who can't be here. Stuff, you know, so that I can listen to it later. That kind of thing. So
there's also a chair up here if someone wants to come.
There's one chair up here, yeah, if you have small legs. And so, is there any objections?
I will take a small chair.
Okay, anybody else?
I'd like to ask that people be respectful of the possibility of children being in the workshop, and if they need to be, to just talk louder, as opposed to asking the children to leave.
Yeah.
Great. Okay. And if anybody has like a open seat beside them, just raise their hand, and that we can do a count of how many chairs in case anybody else walks in. There's just one open chair.
There's
two.
One over
there's
here.
There's some up at the front. Can we sit up on that?
Yeah, bleachers. Yeah, there's one up here in the front.
So there's three open chairs.
Okay. Anyone else? Okay. All right, so our first presentation is from Kenyon. He's going to be presenting a presentation entitled Yiddish is My Homeland, A Transatlantic History of Jewish American Anarchism in the 1880s through the 1930s.
All right, hello, everyone. I may sort of speed through this since we are pressed for time and it's a lot of information. So bear with me. And, you know, if you have questions on anything, that's what the question and answer period is for. Basically, why should we pay attention to what's mostly lost history of Yiddish language anarchism in the United States, North America, and elsewhere? First is, most of what most people know about Jewish anarchism in the United States is all about Emma Goldman, and maybe Alexander Berkman. But the fact is, Emma Goldman wrote and spoke in Yiddish not too often, was on the margins of the Yiddish-speaking anarchist movement in her views, and is not at all representative of this movement, which in fact was the largest ethnic anarchist movement in United States history. And if we want to talk about Yiddish anarchists, it's better for us to look at anarchists actually speaking and writing in Yiddish rather than German and English, which is what Goldman was mostly doing. And if we want to talk about Jewish, Russian Jewish immigrant anarchist women, well, Goldman is, of course, a fantastic figure. She is one among very many. Unfortunately, the very many have been forgotten. People like Katerina Yevsarov-Marison, who was a university-educated Russian Jewish immigrant who, in the United States, got her medical license, wrote broadly for the Yiddish socialist and anarchist press on the woman question, on feminism, with a very intriguing pamphlet called Women in Society, using anthropological evidence to argue for essentially the social construction of gender roles across societies. I think these are people who ought to be remembered. So I'm going to show a lot of photographs of people you won't recognize as we go through this. Why else is it important to look at these particular at this particular movement? For better or for worse, depending on your standpoint, Jewish anarchism in the United States was very distinct in its outlook and in its evolution. It became, after the turn of the century, a sort of evolutionary view of anarchism, which sort of distanced itself from not merely propaganda by the deed, but insurrection, and even ideas of sort of revolution with a capital R, looked to towards a gradual transformation of society through education, through labor unions, through cooperatives. Jewish anarchists worked very actively within the mainstream labor movement, within the American Federation of Labor. It was a highly organized movement. It had annual North American conferences where major decisions, such as editorship of the main Yiddish language anarchist newspaper, were decided. In 1921, a Jewish Anarchist Federation of North America was formed, which had 21 chapters at its founding. So this is a highly, you know, interconnected, organized, and in many ways atypical anarchist movement in some of its viewpoints. It was also a movement filled with intellectuals, filled with dense, sophisticated, and diverse theoretical debates, which I will touch on slightly here. It was also incredibly influential within the Jewish immigrant community in North America. It was more influential probably than anarchism amongst any other group in the Americas. And it was also incredibly influential transnationally, which I'll get to. One of the interesting aspects of this movement is that this Russian Jewish anarchism did not originate in Russia. There were no anarchist groups in the entire territory of the Russian Empire until 1903, when the first began to be formed in the Pale of Settlement. But the first Yiddish-speaking anarchist group in the United States was formed in 1887. The origins of this movement lie in New York's Lower East Side and in London's East End, amongst displaced, mostly garment workers working in sweatshops, living in tenement housing. These are the people who first formed Yiddish language anarchist groups. And if you look at accounts from people, even including Emma Goldman, Alexander Berkman, you look, they've never heard of anarchism before arriving in the United States. They've been involved in radical circles, reading radical literature in Russia, but not anarchist literature, not anarchist groups. It's in the United States that they sort of discover anarchism. By all accounts, from the contemporary time, anarchism was the dominant trend within the Jewish left and Jewish labor movement in the United States in the 1880s and early 1890s. But importantly, that was not the heyday of Yiddish anarchism, which I'll get to. And the evolution of this movement is very much tied to the languages in which it was spoken, and it went through a complex evolution. The people who would become these sort of leading figures, the leading writers and organizers and theoreticians of Jewish anarchism in the United States, were Russian-speaking Jews. They were assimilated in Russia. They were mostly educated. Immigrated to the United States, looked down on Yiddish as a jargon. That was sort of a mark of inferiority. They spoke in Yiddish. They first organized Russian language radical groups. Then they became exposed to the anarchism of the German-American immigrants. people like Johann Most, who was an incredibly influential figure on these anarchists. And so for a few years in the 1880s, Jewish anarchism was essentially a sort of appendage to the German language movement. They didn't have their own publications. They were going to talks by Johann Most. They were reading stuff in German, which for those who grew up with Yiddish, was Yiddish and German are very closely related languages, so you could mostly understand what was being read and said. And then it's only in the 1890s that really a Yiddish language, a Yiddish-speaking movement emerges as these groups start to realize that if we want to organize our fellow immigrants, we need to speak the language they're speaking. We need to embrace Yiddish, which in sort of short order, the anarchist movement did to a very remarkable degree. The mainstream, if you want to call it that, Yiddish anarchist newspaper in North America, and then after the turn of the century, in the world, was the Freie Arbeiterstimme, the Free Voice of Labor, published in New York City. From 1890, with a short break, and it lasted all the way until 1977. If we look at the circulation of this newspaper, that is how many copies of each issue were being published. At its peak in 1914, it reached 30,000 copies per issue. This is the largest circulation of any anarchist publication in North America ever, to my knowledge. Now, most of what has been written, in English at least, about Jewish anarchism concerns this period right over here. And then it says anarchism was no longer important. But really, the heyday is, you know, from the turn of the century until the First World War. And it remains fairly significant. I mean, even though we can see a dramatic drop, you know, a circulation of 5,000 to 10,000 for an anarchist publication, that's still more than most other anarchist publications being produced in North America, at least at the time. And the Freie Arbeiterstimme in that heyday was inseparable from its editor, a man named Saul Janowski. In the words of Frank, and I won't get into who he is, Janowski occupied a dominant position not only in the Yiddish anarchist press, but in all of Yiddish journalism in America. For a few continuous decades, he was the spiritual trailblazer for innumerable Jewish journalists, writers, actors, trade union organizers, and community leaders of Jewish society, and hence in the social life of millions of immigrant Jews in their new home. I would argue this is not an exaggeration. This was an incredibly important and influential newspaper, both in the world of Yiddish literature, and Janowski was renowned for discovering new talent in Yiddish poetry, in Yiddish playwrights. Many of the most famous and successful Yiddish poets were first published in the anarchist newspaper, the Freie Arbeiterstimme. Janowski was probably the most influential anarchist in North American history, in terms of the number of people reached by him and influenced by his ideas and by the paper that he was editing. In the first two decades of the 20th century alone, 11 anarchist groups existed in New York City by itself, not to mention Philadelphia, Detroit, Toronto, Montreal, San Francisco, St. Louis, Denver, Patterson, Chicago. So this was a widespread influential movement, and within the Yiddish immigrant world, it was a pervasive, it was part of the mainstream Yiddish world. Everyone knew who Saul Janowski was, even if they didn't agree with him. If you were an aspiring actor, playwright, poet, writer, you respected you respected Janowski and his opinion, you read the Freie Arbeiterstimme. Now, Yiddish anarchists were also very influential within the Jewish labor movement. In the 1880s and 1890s, they were at the forefront of organizing garment workers. When the International Ladies Garment Workers Union was formed, they were no longer the mainstream. They had been displaced by socialists, but they were an important faction within the ILGWU. From 1923 to 1928, the presidency of the ILGWU was held by a man named Morris Zygmunt, who was an anarchist. You had other people, like better known is Rose Posada, who was an organizer and vice president of the ILGW. But these figures represent hundreds of anarchists taking an active role. There were dozens of anarchists who were heads of various locals, heads and had other official positions, and then there were many more who were rank and file activists who played a major role in organizing Jewish workers. New York was also, after the turn of the century, the center of a wider transatlantic Yiddish anarchist world. The Freie Arbeit Stimme was distributed in Canada, in Argentina, South Africa, Egypt, France, Britain, Russia, Palestine, and other places where you had Jewish immigrant enclaves. And in return, if you go through the pages of the Freie Arbeit Stimme, they're getting financial contributions from readers in all of these continents. They're getting, you know, it's very common to flip through a letter from Africa, and it's, you know, someone writing what's going on in Alexandria, Egypt, or in Johannesburg. You know, a letter from France, and so forth. So it's part of a much larger world, and it becomes the center of it. It's the preeminent newspaper for this movement. It has especially strong connections to London. There's a lot of going back and forth. At one point in 1899, London and New York actually swap editors for their newspapers. They sort of cross it. And Solyanowski edits the London paper for a bit. Also very important for the late coming anarchist movement in Russia, which again, the first anarchist groups in the Russian Empire formed in 1903. In 1905, when revolution breaks out, hundreds of Jewish anarchists residing in North America return to Russia, and they take up important positions in this emerging anarchist movement as part of the revolution of 1905, which is then crushed. In 1917, the same thing happens. And if you actually go through and read accounts of the Russian of anarchism in the Russian Revolution, whether it's Paul Average's book or even Arshinov's book or whatever, you find suddenly, if you trace the background of a lot of the leading figures, especially in the anarcho-syndicalist movement in Russia, they were all coming back from the United States. They had all been in the United States, had been members of the IWW, they'd been reading the Freie Arbeit Stimme. The vast majority of them had become anarchists in the United States and then returned to Russia and helped the, you know, this movement spring back to life. So rather than the conventional view that anarchism is sort of imported from abroad, this was pretty much literally anarchism being exported from New York to Russia. And I want to cover a sort of central debate within Yiddish anarchism, and a sort of pervasive issue was, what is Jewishness? And what is its relation to nationalism? Like, the national question, which was, of course, an overriding question for Jewish immigrants and Jews in general in this era, the anarchists could not escape this question. And there were a variety of approaches and a very sophisticated and dense theoretical debate, which I'm going to summarize briefly here. The first coherent Yiddish anarchist statement on Jewish nationalism and its relationship to anarchism was published in 1899 in a paper called Wahrheit, and it was written by a man named Moshe Katz. He argued, essentially, that Jews were not a nation because they lacked the territory. They were not defined by religion because you had atheist Jews. He argued that Jews were not defined by language because you had, you know, Ashkenazi Jews who spoke Yiddish, you had Sephardic Jews who spoke a different language, you had, you know, assimilated Jews who spoke languages of their, you know, adopted languages. He argued that Jews were a people, or in Yiddish, a folk. And they did not have a territory, a nation state, they did not need one, and that in fact, really the defining characteristic of Jewishness was anti-Semitism. That Jews, that essentially Jews as a category existed because they were persecuted by anti-Semites. And that the only way to overcome this anti-Semitism was through social revolution. And then more or less at that point, implied in this argument is Jews as a category don't, you know, would no longer matter. This is sort of the earliest statement. In 1903, there's a massive pogrom that breaks out in Chisinau, in what is now Romania, which sparks a major sort of soul-searching amongst Jews and the Jewish left everywhere. Hillel Zolotarov, who was a leading Yiddish anarchist intellectual in New York, created sort of a scandal when he starts writing that, you know, the Yiddish people, the Yiddish folk, need a territory, that that they need to embrace, the anarchists need to embrace nationalism, not a nationalism based on religion, not a nationalism based on culture, but a nationalism simply based on survival. That for Jews to continue to exist, at least in Europe, they need an autonomous territory so that they can defend themselves and not be annihilated through pogroms and anti-Semitism. This is a very controversial statement. It sort of creates a huge upheaval. And it's a minority viewpoint, but an important one. After the First World War, both Kautz and Zolotarov and a few others move further into the nationalist camp. They become members of Poale Zion, the labor Zionist, the socialist Zionist movement, who now argue that Jews are a folk and they temporarily need a nation state, again, for their very survival as a people. So here we have what they in Yiddish call anarcho-nationalism. Right? And especially their opponents refer to them as anarcho-nationalists. And it's an interesting fusion. But they insist, even as they're embracing a form of Zionism, that a state of Israel will blossom into an anarchist communist society eventually. And actually some of the leading theoreticians of the Poale Zion movement lean pretty heavily towards the anarchist side. People like Bear Bartokov writes that he's a Marxist anarchist, and that he doesn't believe in a future state of Israel, but it's, you know, a sort of short-term solution. But all of this is a minority current. The mainstream, if we can call it that, of Jewish anarchism, represented by Saul Yanovsky and Freiherr Arbeiter Stimme, is that all of the stuff about territorialism, let alone Zionism, you know, even a territory is really just another word for a state. And it's going, in order to protect a territory, you will need a military and you will need a government, and that will just be a state, and that is not anarchism. And he's, you know, he says that the people like Kautz and Zolotarov, they're heretics, they're not kosher. They're not kosher anarchists. And instead, people like Yanovsky and the Freiherr Arbeiter Stimme embrace the idea of Yiddishkeit. Now, Yiddishkeit, it's a Yiddish word that literally means both Jewishness and Yiddishness. And it's a term that's used widely amongst immigrant Jews to sort of describe the secular Yiddish language culture of immigrant Jews. And people like Alexander Harkavy, who was the foremost Jewish philologist, a studier of language. He published a Yiddish-English dictionary that's still in print. He was also an anarchist. He was a member of the first Yiddish anarchist group formed in 1887. He argued, as an anarchist, that Jews were an international nation defined by the Yiddish language. They did not need a territory or a state. Essentially, Jewishness was defined by Yiddish. And he was a major player in basically getting Yiddish recognized as a legitimate language rather than a dialect or a jargon. Later, this is sort of followed up on by the Jewish literary critic and anarchist again, B. Rifkin, who famously argued that Yiddish literature, modern Yiddish literature, fulfilled the same function that the Jewish religion had previously in creating what he called a spiritual territory for the Jews, which was sort of a tenuous stand-in for an actual territory for Jews. But basically, that through a Yiddish language culture, this was all that was needed to have a sort of Jewish people, have a sense of peoplehood. And his idea, he also was sort of a territorialist at times, but that's a whole other story. But this idea of these competing ideas were labeled by one future editor of the Freiherr Arbeiter Stimme as the difference between what he called ethno-cultural freedom and world-destroying ethnocentrism. That is, making a distinction between an ethnocentrist nationalism, which would declare Jewishness superior to other people, to other peoplehoods, to other ways of being, as opposed to ethno-cultural freedom, which is just freedom to embrace an ethnic identity and have other people embrace an ethnic identity, so there's no conflict involved. And you see this sort of summed up in the words of Arne Thorne, who was the final editor of the Freie Arbeiter Stimme. He said, "I have no country of my own, so to speak. I'm a citizen of America. I consider myself part of American society, but Yiddish is my homeland. To anarchists, your identity is what you feel. It means be true to yourself. If you feel like a Jew, fine, perfect. If you love Yiddish, great, build it. But it's this sort of give and take cosmopolitan attitude that, you know, you can be a Jewish anarchist fully invested in Yiddish, and that's fully anarchistic, and it's not in but it's not in conflict with other ways of being and other ways of being an anarchist. Slide. How am I doing on time? All right. Now, I won't get into fully the reasons why this movement declined. I can get into the question and answers if you want. But the Second World War and the Holocaust and the revelations about the Holocaust eventually shifts anarchist discourse, Jewish anarchist discourse. Following the Holocaust, the majority of Yiddish-speaking anarchists and readers of the Freie Arbeit Stimme sort of reconcile themselves to Zionism, to the state of Israel, as, you know, a necessity born out of massive tragedy, and essentially embrace the earlier viewpoint of the anarcho-nationalist members of Poale Zion, that this is a sort of temporary necessity simply to ensure the survival of the Jewish people. Now, there's still plenty of conflict, and actually, Hermann Frank, one of the editors of the Freie Arbeit Stimme, gets kicked out of his post because he refuses to go along with that viewpoint. But, again, that was not the dominant viewpoint. And I just want to end with one little story that sort of goes against the grain and I think demonstrates, one, the real transatlantic network that was forged by these Yiddish-speaking anarchists and really gets to sort of the heart of anarchist aspirations for anti-nationalism. So in 1946, right after the Second World War, Rose Posada, whose picture I showed earlier, who was an anarchist and a vice president of the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, toured Eastern Europe on behalf of the ILGWU to help, which had a program for relief of, you know, Jewish refugees from the Holocaust. She was visiting what remained of the Łódź ghetto in Poland, which had been, right, a Nazi Jewish ghetto. The vast majority of the population had been killed. There were about 900 survivors in total in the Łódź ghetto. So she's there with her, you know, her delegation from the ILGWU, and a man comes running up to her, waving a newspaper in his hand. It's the Freie Arbeit Stimme. Turns out, this guy is an anarchist. He's a reader of the Freie Arbeit Stimme. He's a lifelong friend of some of Posada's comrades back in New York City. He's a member of what this anarchist group that existed in the Łódź ghetto. Only a few members survived. Most of them were killed by the Nazis. And he knows her through the Freie Arbeit Stimme, you know, through her anarchist activism. She writes in her little report back, after meeting, you know, this handful of survivors, curiously enough, none of them asked for help for themselves or for visas, but all they wanted was moral support, literature, a printing press, and a linotype machine in Polish. It's important. They wanted to publish Polish language translations of anarchist works. So here we have a group, a half dozen or so, Jews who've just survived the Holocaust in Poland, where the Polish population in general is not sympathetic to the Jews' plight. And in the remnants of this Nazi ghetto, all they want to do is to disseminate anarchist ideas to their Polish neighbors. So even the Holocaust could not extinguish their aspirations, or push them sort of over the precipice into nationalism. Right? They didn't want to get out. They didn't want to go to Palestine or Israel. They wanted to stay there and continue their work, which I think really speaks volumes to this particular group's own perseverance, but to the hopes and possibilities that anarchism could provide, even in such an atrocious context. And I guess I'll just end with that.
a presentation about Panama Reds, anarchist politics, trans-regional networks in the Panama Canal Zone, 1904 to 1916.
Hi, everybody. I'll stand up so I don't have any beautiful slides. So
I'll just do that for now.
So, but Steve will bring you back into the visualist page. Yes. I get the chance to listen to Kenyon every couple of years talk about this stuff, and I'm just blown away by it every time I hear him. You know, it's so cool. All right. So listen, what I'm doing is, as Nathan said, I got into this gig about a decade ago researching anarchism in Cuba, and wrote this book 5-6 years ago now on Cuban anarchism. And all the time I'm writing this book about Cuban anarchism, it's dawning on me, you know, we get into this habit of writing about anarchists in one country, right? And we all know from contemporary, from today, as well as historically, that anarchists rarely thought of themselves as nation-bound. They saw themselves as internationalists or transnationalists, right? And so what I started doing after I wrote that Cuba book was thinking, well, let's look and see if there are any anarchists throughout the broader Caribbean. Nobody's really said anything about them. One here, two there, that's about it. And so you start looking at the old labor histories written about Puerto Rico or Southern Florida or Panama, and the anarchists kind of pop up here and there. You get a situation, for instance, a couple years ago, a historian wrote about the laborers building the Panama Canal, which is what I'm going to focus on today. And it's a really fine history, and she's got some great stuff on the anarchists. And she says that the anarchists existed from 1907 to 1912. They must have just stopped. You know why they stopped? Because the U.S. political authorities governing the canal zone stopped reporting on them. Mm-hmm. So interesting. So how do we find out about these people? All we have are the government surveillance archives, right? What we find, in fact, are a lot more sources to help us unpack the fact that there were anarchists throughout the Caribbean, that there were anarchists not only throughout the Caribbean, but anarchists who rose up and interacted with each other and created anarchist networks throughout the Caribbean in the first two decades of the 20th century. And we find this out not by looking at the government records, but by reading the anarchist press. The anarchist press in Cuba, you start seeing these letters from the Panama Canal Zone. The Spanish anarchist press, you start seeing the letters from the Panama Canal Zone. You start putting names, faces together. You start tracing the flows of money as anarchists in Panama are sending money here, sending money there. And you start to say, shit, there's a children. There's something going on here, right? There's something going on here. And in fact, there are anarchists. So what I'm going to talk about just briefly today is just one of the spokes of this network that was developed in the Caribbean. And that's the anarchists in the Panama Canal Zone. All right. Now, put this in some context. When we're looking at the early 20th century, what we see is the Caribbean is involved in three overlapping anarchist networks. There's the Caribbean network, all right, which is South Florida, Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Panama Canal Zone. You have the eastern coast of the United States, which is, and through the Caribbean, so you have Puerto Rico, Cuba, South Florida, up to New York. And you have the transatlantic network that stretches back into Spain. And you have all three of them coordinating, operating, sending cash, communications, and flesh, people, migrants, throughout these networks. The hub of these networks, the one linchpin that puts them all together, is Havana, Cuba. All right? Now, so what happens is these networks start to really operate in the 1890s when Cuba gets its war for independence, seeking its war for independence. The anarchists, after some hesitation, join in the Cuban fight for independence in the 1890s.
you get the Florida anarchists, the Cuban anarchists, the Spanish anarchists, and New York anarchists all sort of working together to support, you know, this cause for independence. Well, the war ends in 1898, not because the anarchists win, obviously, not because the Cubans win, obviously, because the United States invades and wins the war and signs the peace treaty with Spain. Now, the thing is that the United States in 1898 realized that, you know, if the United States really wants to become this mover and shaker on the international stage, if the United States wants to be an empire without calling itself an empire, it's got to figure out a better way to get its warships and its freight cargo from the Atlantic to the Pacific and vice versa. All right. So, after a long series of machinations, the United States helps this old Colombian province of Panama get its independence. And sort of a tit for tat, because the United States helps Panama get its independence in 1903, Panama agrees to sever itself in half and award a 10-mile-wide strip of land to the United States to build a canal through. So from 1904 to 1914, the United States starts to build this canal. All right? The United States needs workers to build the canal. The largest sets of workers come from the French and British West Indies, black workers, and from Spain. And guess who comes with the Spanish workers? The anarchists. Now, in 1904, the United States had actually passed, there was an executive decree forbidding anarchists from arriving in the Panama Canal Zone. It must have worked for a bit, but we see our first anarchist in the Panama Canal Zone in 1905, just a year after the decree. And we know this because what's he done? He's written a letter and sent money to a newspaper in Cuba, which publishes it. It's like, oh, shit, there they are. Okay, let's see what happens. Now, not much happens for many years. In about 1907 to 1910, you start seeing more and more anarchists coming into the canal zone. And what they're doing is they're writing newspaper columns, sending them back to Cuba and sending them back to Spain. They're reporting on conditions in the canal zone. They're criticizing the American overseers who are, like, you know, docking them pay for, like, throwing orange peels on the ground. They're criticizing other workers for not being, you know, sufficiently engaged in the anarchist struggle. They are critiquing religion in the canal zone. Because the United States had a policy, the people who ran the canal zone, called the Isthmian Canal Commission, they actually had a policy of encouraging churches to set up churches in the canal zone. And the anarchists interpreted this as a way of de-radicalizing workers. Workers would go to church instead of to the meetings. Now, all that's said and done, there's still not much going on. They're all just sending letters and money out along these networks, these trails. Until 1911, here's where it gets interesting. In 1911, an anarchist by the name of Manuel Rodriguez arrives in Panama, arrives in the canal zone. Now, this is a guy who was a Spaniard, but he was an international anarchist. He had gone to Argentina, where he was involved in strike activities in 1907 and 1908, before he was deported. From Argentina, he went to Cuba, where he worked with Cuban anarchists from 1908 to 1910. He leaves at the end of 1910, arrives in the Panama Canal Zone in early 1911. And from Panama, from the Canal Zone, he too starts to write these letters, particularly to Spain. Here's what's going on. These are the conditions. You know, if any more Spaniards want to come to the canal to work, be aware, this is what you're going to face. Right? You're going to be exploited. Now, Rodriguez does something very interesting. By about August of 1911, Rodriguez begins to build an anarchist movement in the canal zone. And remember, official policy is there shouldn't be any anarchists here in the first place. For some odd reason, the United States never tries to quash these people. They allow them to organize. And so Rodriguez starts to create these groups throughout the Canal Zone, all right? But he does some other things. He takes these groups and he organizes them into the Panama Anarchist Federation, okay? First such organization in really the isthmus of Central America. By August of 1911, he is founding the International Individualist Federation. This is key. He's an individualist anarchist. He's a follower of Stirner, who rejects the anarcho-communists. He rejects the anarcho-syndicalists. And this is going to cause problems. We'll get to that in a second. Then, at the end of August and early September 1911, Rodriguez creates the first anarchist newspaper in the Canal Zone. It's called El Único. And in El Único, he continues to, you know, assault the U.S., assault the religion. He continues to encourage people to organize. And he starts to raise money. Now, here's this transnationalism coming into play. What's he raising money for? He organizes all these anarchists in Panama to raise money, not for their own movement. You've got to remember something here. These are all immigrants. There's not a single native, whatever a native would be in the Canal Zone, anarchist. They're all immigrants. This is unique to the whole Western Hemisphere experience. So they all know they're all going to be leaving eventually. Okay? They know they're only there for a time being. So they're not really interested in creating this long-term movement. They're in Panama organizing, raising money to send money to support internationalist causes. And the big international cause he sets out is to raise money to send back to Spain, where Spaniards can buy a printing press all their own. Now, those of you who know anything about the anarchist press, particularly historically, know that the anarchist newspapers are always going into debt. They're always going into debt. And they go from one printer to another to another. So Rodriguez has set out to create his own, they help the Spaniards create their own anarchist printing press, so they don't have to rely on anybody else, and they can begin to create daily anarchist newspapers. They would then be sent throughout the networks around the world. Okay. All right. Interesting. Now, the problem is, that's August, September 1911. Within months, anarchism in the Canal Zone explodes. I don't mean in a good way. A civil war between anarchists erupts. Anarchists start attacking one another in the zone. Rodriguez is the main culprit. He starts to attack fellow anarchists in the zone who don't subscribe to his individualist ways. All right? He writes in his newspaper, El Único, that's going abroad, he says, don't send money to this particular newspaper in Havana. The newspaper is Tierra. If anybody knows anything about Tierra, the newspaper of Havana, this is the number one anarchist newspaper in the entire Caribbean. And he say, don't send money to them. They're a bunch of untrustworthy anarcho-communists. Don't send money to them. What does he encourage, though? He encourages people to send money to a brand new rival newspaper in Havana called Via Libre. Now, makes a long story short, let me give you a feel for what's happening. Rodriguez and his Panamanian anarchists become the number one financiers of this Cuban newspaper. They are the number one financiers of the international individualist movement. And this is an interesting movement. It's got subscribers from Cuba, the U.S., Argentina, Panama, Vancouver. Spanish-speaking anarchists in Vancouver. There's one to think about, right? But then he steps over the line. It's one thing to attack Tierra. But then he starts attacking the Mexican Revolution. And Ricardo Flores Magón, the PLM and the Magonistas based in Los Angeles, he attacks them. He says, they're not worthy of the name anarchism. Don't send them any money. And he's got, you know, you got to understand his rationale. One, he doesn't like them because they're communists. But two, anarcho-communists. But two, he doesn't like them because, look, if you start sending money to support the anarchist wing of the Mexican Revolution, what you're doing is you're asking workers to send money to support them instead of using that money locally for other initiatives. For instance, local newspapers. And in fact, in Cuba, as the Cubans began to send money to support the PLM and Flores Magón, 1910, 1911, 1912, the amount of money they send to support their anarchist schools in Havana declines. As money goes to support the PLM from Havana, money to support anarchist papers in Cuba declines. There's only, you know, limited resources to tap into. Now, that was his rationale. Really, he just hated the communists. So what we have here now is the development of two rival anarchist international networks. There are anarchists in Panama, in the Panama Canal Zone, like Rodriguez, who supports Via Libre in Havana, who supports a particular newspaper in Spain. Then there are anarchists in the Panama Canal Zone who don't like Rodriguez, who are communists, who continue to support Tierra in Cuba and other newspapers in Spain. In Panama, in 1911 and 1912, there are two rival transnational anarchist networks at work. The thing is, as Rodriguez begins to use his network to attack one of them, guess what happens? The other one rallies around and starts to attack him. Flores Magón gets into the act. He says, you can't trust this bastard. You know? Anarchists who knew him in Spain say, you can't trust him. Anarchists in Cuba say, you can't trust him. Eventually, by mid-1912, there's no more money coming to Rodriguez's newspaper. He has to fold it. And shortly, by the end of 1912, early 1913, as I wind down today, by the end of 1912, 1913, these two rival networks of individualists and communists, they start working together again, pooling resources to buy each other's rival newspapers abroad. Why? How did this rapprochement happen? Rodriguez seems to have disappeared. His former allies in the Individualist Federation, they write to papers in Spain. Have you seen him? Where is he? We don't know. If you're reading this, Mr. Rodriguez, please get in touch with your old comrades. Otherwise, we have to fear the worst. And you know what the worst is, right? It's not death. It's betrayal. You've taken off with all of our money. He drops completely out of the historical record. I've never been able to find a trace of him since. Now, here's the final thing I'll leave you with. As we looking at transnational anarchism, we're always looking at these linkages, these flows of people, these flows of cash, these flows of migrants moving about. And we're always looking at how these networks develop and how these networks function. One thing we don't necessarily always look at is what threatened these networks. One thing that threatened the network was, of course, governments, you know, arresting people, deporting people, confiscating mail, etc. But another big threat to these networks was the element of trust. These were long-term projects, as Charles Tilly said in 2005 in a book. You know, he said, he doesn't talk about anarchists, but it applies. These were long-term political projects in which people formed these networks, not through official organizations, but through informal personal connections. And when people did that, they were essentially trusting somebody. Trusting them to raise the right money, trusting them to buy the subscriptions. Trust was key to these networks. When you got somebody like Rodriguez who turned on anarchists, he broke that trust and threatened the network. And then you had the communist network that came around. They responded, and they went after him, drove him away, and essentially, the other international network recreated an element of trust that allowed for these networks to then continue operating.
Constructing a working class counterculture, transnational anarchism in the anarchist press in northern Peru, 1898-1922.
Thank you for your patience and tolerance in this sort of cramped and sort of semi-sweltering environment, you know, freezing out there. I hope everyone by now is persuaded from both Kenyon and Kirk's presentations. I've been certainly persuaded by them having been privy to them over the years as well, the importance of looking at anarchism as an international movement and as a transnational phenomenon, both historically and in its current incarnation. I've been part of this project in the book that was referred to, the edited volume, and here's a bit of shameless self-promotion. I brought some flyers, if for those of you interested. Fortunately, the hardcover is very expensive, but maybe a local university would buy it, and you'll have it available. We're trying to get in paperback edition. But at any rate, this is part of a project that this collective here that we're working on to decenter anarchism. That is, from focusing strictly on Europe and a lot of the Eurocentric history, and looking at anarchism in the global South, which essentially what is in the particular book on anarchism in the colonial and post-colonial world. You know, we examine anarchist movements in Asia and Africa, Middle East, and Latin America, which we argue were larger and arguably even more important than those found in Europe. And I think one can even see some continuity between those movements in the 1880s to 1940 and current movements in the global South today. But again, I want to stress the importance of this transnationalism. As a prism, a lens to understand anarchism as an international phenomenon. One other thing we're trying to do, in addition to decentering it, is to look at sort of the periphery. My work on Peru, as you can imagine, not many people are familiar with Peruvian anarchism, but I would argue it not only was it the most important radical ideology and movement in Peru for much of the about the 1890s to about 1930, but it's been revived and is resurgent there. And in fact, Peruvians today are looking back at the past for inspiration to draw lessons from that. So this is part of a larger project that I'm involved in, a book project called tentatively. Study, Organize, Rebel. This is from a masthead from one of the other anarchist papers in Peru. Study, Organize, Rebel, A History of Anarchist Currents in Peru, 1890 to 1930. What I'm looking at here is essentially a case of anarchism, the periphery of the periphery, right? A case of peripheral anarchism, but even a periphery within Peru. And if there's any sort of take-home point that I want to stress here, it's that scholars and activists interested in understanding anarchism have overlooked this peripheral geography of anarchism. That is, anarchism not in the large metropoles or capitals or centers of commerce, but actually on the periphery, rural towns, small towns. Anarchism penetrated these areas. And in the case of Peru, which in comparison to Argentina and the Brazilian cases, or even Mexico, which were much more developed and one could argue more advanced anarchist and anarcho-syndicalist movements during this period, granted they there was a parallel in that it was centered in Lima, Callao, which was the most industrialized center and in Peru, metropole. But by comparison to Buenos Aires, since Lima had maybe 300,000 inhabitants, and Buenos Aires had topped over a million, right? And the same can be said of Rio de Janeiro and Mexico City and so on. But if you look out at the smaller towns, like I'm going to look at momentarily here, but here's a map, sort of a crude map, but I thought it might give you an idea for those of you to visualize what Peru looks like. And you can see in the legend there that there's typically we think of Peru in terms of three type of regions, or I should say geographic and ecological zones. The coastal area, which is largely desert in these places, and then the Andes region with fertile valleys, and then the Amazonian region in the green. And I'm focusing on those cities, the provincial capitals north of Lima, Trujillo, Chiclayo, and Piura. In this case, I'm just focusing on Trujillo and Chiclayo, which maybe were towns of 20, 30,000 inhabitants. But they were very seamlessly integrated with the surrounding... What happened there? It's the projector.
Maybe
overheated? It
could be the cord
to
the projector.
Nothing
moved.
It
should be okay.
Okay, good. There we go. We want to slight Peru. So, what you don't see on this map here, which I'll spend more time on, is that Trujillo, Chiclayo were very much a part of the surrounding rural areas where you had large sugar and cotton plantations owned by Peruvian oligarchs as well as wealthy foreign immigrants like German planters, and then later U.S. Corporate multinational firms like W.R. Grace. Right. So. But I'm going to talk about this rural-urban connection later, but it's important to think about this. So what I want to stress again is just how important it is that we not look for anarchism only in, you know, capital cities or the most highly developed areas of even the global south, but actually think about it in terms of peripheral areas, because anarchism really had far-reaching influence that I don't think has been heretofore acknowledged or studied. Now, the other point that I would say that I want to make is that these movements, I don't want us to also knee-jerk or jump to the conclusion, well, those small anarchist movements, you know, let's say, okay, yeah, you've discovered the existence of anarchists and anarcho-syndicalists and movements, and, you know, that they were necessarily subordinate to, right? Or taking direction from larger movements, whether they were in Lima or whether they were in Buenos Aires or somewhere else. One of the unique, I think, and important features, distinguishing features, I would say, of anarchism, of course, is this, that it's rooted in decentralized, you know, grassroots level types of organization. And what I'm going to be talking about today are movements in Trujillo and Chiclayo that were very much autonomous, you know, community-based and centered movements that, yes, drew inspiration from transnational, national movements, but essentially they constructed their own living anarchism, right? So this is important to take into account. My research in connection to northern Peru focuses on four major anarchist papers. And you can see sort of the time frame that I'm operating in, that we're in existence. La Antorcha, or the Torch, was from 1903 to 1907, based in Trujillo. Its editor and founder was Julio Reynaga Matute, and I'm going to talk more about him in a moment. And El Jornalero, and El Jornalero meaning referring to sort of day laborers or wage laborers, from 1906 to 1915, again founded by Reynaga Matute. And the Free Protest in Chiclayo, founded by Manuel Ucho from Patasca. And later, below that, La Abeja, which means the bee. And I'll explain why that has that peculiar title momentarily, by Manuel Ucho from Patasca. It's worth noting, however, that both of these individuals are native Peruvians, and that, in fact, Peru, unlike the Southern Cone or Brazil or even Chile for that matter, was not a recipient of large numbers of European immigrants. Yes, there were some, but not in any significant numbers, and certainly not many in terms of workers. So the Peruvian anarchist movement and the anarcho-syndicalist movement is largely an indigenous one. But there are exceptions. There are foreign immigrants there too. So one other thing I should point out, again, this may be a comparison here with what Kenyon was mentioning, which I'm still staggered by, that these figures of 30,000 helping in publication. I mean, in these cases, these papers, they were printing between 1,000 and 3,000, right? That was the number of circulars. But in these small towns of 20,000, and bear in mind, we'll talk a little bit about this, you know, people would buy, you know, one paper, and then, of course, they would share it, and they would spread it around, and so, you know, one paper could go a long way in Peru. And these papers were routinely distributed in both the urban towns, both in Chiclayo and Trujillo, but also among the day laborers and workers on the sugar plantations and cotton plantations. And I'll have more to say about that also. Let me say a word about Julio Reynaga Matute. I'm going to show you a rare photo of him later. He's a mulatto. A mulatto, a port worker, former port worker, a mechanic. He was an enthusiastic, ardent, you know, anarcho-syndicalist. He was also a dance aficionado. In fact, he opened up his own little dance studio for anarchists in Trujillo. And got a lot of people involved in the anarchist movement as a result of that. And then there's Manuel Ucho from Patasca, who was a print worker, a carpenter, and a journalist. And he, too, was a fairly fervent anarchist. Both of them used their papers to report on international news. In fact, it's remarkable the extent to which, how well informed they were. Of course, literally from the events in China or Russia to Africa, pertaining to worker struggles in particular, or Spain, or even the United States. They disseminated anarchist doctrine, and of course, this is the key thing. I know he didn't intentionally omit this, but when Kurt was mentioning about flows, and flows of people and money and everything. Of course, it's the information, it's the doctrine that's crucial too. And people writing, you know, it's the spread of these ideas and fusion of ideas. And that's what's, I think, very important in the Peruvian case. They also promoted, they were a working class organization. solidarity, class struggle, and in particular, they inculcated a countercultural set of beliefs and values. Education was paramount. Again, we can talk about, I think all three of us on this panel have sort of stressed how it seems to me there's some commonality here that the anarchists in these cases are looking at the long durée. You know, they're looking down the road. They don't see, they're not talking about immediate revolution. They're talking about building up changing a certain social consciousness. And preparing people to culturally emancipate themselves. In a country like Peru, this was particularly important because by the turn of the century, one could argue all the way to today, the wealthy dominated all the centers of education. It was really very exclusionary. You couldn't even attend high school or even college for that matter if you were born into the working classes. And the working class ultimately had to educate themselves, and anarchists were committed to that objective. And so many of them were self-educated, autodidact types. Let's get on to the next one. So I just wanted to show you some of what the mastheads were, since I didn't have time to sort of scan some of these papers. But the emphasis here, if you just look up here and you read, is that essentially they were very much stressing a working class. 5 minutes. I thought you were going to give me. Now this is too late. Okay. They stressed a working class orientation, right? It was all about anarchists as a class struggle and working class type of movement. Okay. All right. Now we're getting late here. Our influence of transnational anarchism. This is sort of very schematic, but as you can see, just doing a content analysis of these papers, these four, and by the way, there are many. I mean, there are at least 20 anarchist papers that I've encountered, but they were short-lived. Most of them were ephemeral. The four that I've kind of had very steady over the years. So you can see they published writings by Gori and Kropotkin, Reclus, and Spaniards like Pellicer, and Mexicans like Flores Magón. They even had lots of coverage of IWW, Malatesta, and so on. They had, and this is very important, what were known as concaves, right? These free exchanges of papers. In other words, they would send their papers to Buenos Aires, to Spain, to Italy, to wherever they were communicating with. And they, in return, received these papers and from, as you can see here, from Spain, from Barcelona, from Cuba, from Argentina, from Chile, and the list goes on. And then, of course, then they disseminated this information. So they were very much helping to promote an international outlook and to think of themselves in terms of a larger movement. Expressions of solidarity and symbolic practices, of course, this was ritualized and very important. May Day celebrations, particularly commemorations of worker massacres. This goes back to what was talked about this morning, the importance of recognizing those people who sacrificed, not letting their sacrifices go in vain, and carrying on the struggle, particularly the Iquique massacre of Chilean miners in 1907, and then the massacre that took place in Buenos Aires in 1909 on May Day, of government repression. So these would be celebrated in Trujillo and Chiclayo by Peruvians, or there'd be these formal commemorations. Biggest, of course, was the assassination of Francisco Ferrer Guardia, who was, of course, murdered by the Spanish monarch, and who has bequeathed the notion of modern schools, which were also imported into Peru and inspired people like Reynaga and Uchofen Pastaca to create centers of study, right? And all kinds of things is very interesting, but one of the things I want to say here, which is I found fascinating, is this import of the play Martyr. They performed plays, they had theatrical groups, and Mario Lassoni he was an Uruguayan who wrote this libertarian play. It was performed in 1901. The papers actually published the entire play as a serial over a series of weeks, and then they performed it. And they said they were drawn to it because it talked about what they said, proletarian blood, proletarian, and the red flag, and went on and on and on about how important it was for Peruvians to see it. And I just also mentioned here the importance of foreign immigrants. There were two that played an important role in the North, you know, one from Chile, one from Ecuador. And I also want to stress that, and there's some connection here with I've turned up. They also list in these anarchist papers all the voluntary donations. In fact, I've been asking Kirk about it because I see some people from Tierra, some Cubans and Panamanians donating to Peruvian Press anarchist papers. How they knew about these papers, I have no idea. But their names turned up and they gave a dollar or two, right, to keep them afloat. Okay, and then, so here's the countercultural politics, and again, this is not an exhaustive listing, but this is the type of values and beliefs that they were interested in. First of all, there was a whole panoply of cultural organizations that they created. These were all linked to the newspapers, right? They're all linked to these anarchist papers. So they created popular libraries, worker libraries, these centers for sort of studying of anarchists and promoting this kind of book. They had night schools for workers, sports clubs, theaters, music groups. And these were essentially the values. What particularly strikes me that was very important in what was a profoundly racist country, Peru, is their pro-indigenous emancipation and rights movement. And they were very keenly committed to building a worker Indian peasant alliance. And this is what these anarchist presses were involved in outside of Chiclayo and Trujillo, stretching into the haciendas, stretching into the Andean mountains where indigenous peoples were literally forcibly conscripted from their villages to work as rural peons on these commercial estates. And they fought against that. They fought for Indian water rights that were being threatened by big landowners and so on. You can see the morality and the rest, and let me close with maybe a photo. This is one of probably the most famous organizations that was founded by Matute, and you see in the middle of the page there, the guy whose hands are laying on the shoulder, that's Julio Reynaga Matute, the mulatto-looking gentleman there in the middle. And notice, if you will, also, you can just tell the figure of these people. They're, you know, darker looking, they're mestizos or mulattos. Definitely some of indigenous descent in some cases, but yet they're wearing, you know, their ties and they're you know, there was also this pride in this movement, right? They're all wearing ties and suits, and they're very, very dedicated activists, all of them. This was the Anarcho-Syndicalist League of Artisans and Workers of Peru, which was linked to the El Jornalero and newspaper. This is in 1922. I've been working, believe it or not, that they were remarkable. They kept meeting minutes by hand from 1898 to 1922, and I have been working with them to transcribe these, so it's a long process. I hope I live that long. Anyway.
I don't know how much exactly, though. Yes, right.
I'll stand up. Hi. My question is for Kurt and Steve.
Sorry.
What role did women play in any of the anarchist organizing in Latin America?
Women play important roles, particularly in Cuba. They're involved in particularly cultural productions, plays, this type of thing. When husbands are deported, they often continue to agitate. For instance, there's a labor congress in Cuba in 1912, just before it happens. the main organizers deported. His wife is not. She stays and gets the conference going. You see anarchist women here and there. For instance, the famous Luisa Capetillo out of Puerto Rico, who's a transnational. She's operating in Puerto Rico, Cuba, Tampa, New York. In Panama, very, very few. This is primarily because of the whole immigrant nature of this. But there are a few women, and we know of one woman in particular who was a subject of, in 1912, joined the international assault against M.A.D. Rodriguez, Manuel Rodriguez. She wrote a letter to Cuba saying, this guy's not an anarchist. He calls him, so he says, oh my God, they're persecuting me. And she says, he's the real persecutor. You know? So they do rise up. Percentage-wise, it's really hard to tell. They're there. They play key roles. But it is, you know, a male-dominated movement, and even depictions of women and motherhood tend to be fairly patriarchal.
Yeah. I would just add to that, this is a big question, and again, a lot more work needs to be done on this. But again, what is noticeable, or what's noteworthy as far as I'm concerned, is that just how often women's issues are front and center in a lot of these anarchist publications. First of all, they're importing a lot of this stuff from Argentina and Spain, so there is a lot. There is preoccupation about women's education and essentially politicizing women. Women, as Kurt said, were not, you know, the dominant, I say, figures or leaders of these movements. But for example, in Peru, you did have women's union leaders, and you did have female anarcho-syndicalist unions in various factories that I've researched in Lima, in the food industry, for example, and some textile workers. But generally speaking. So there's a commitment there. There's a lot of print information about it, but I still think a lot more work needs to be done before I can make some generalizations.
This gentleman right there in the black.
So I have two questions, actually. One is, you opened your talk saying that the Yiddish anarchist tradition maybe differed a little bit in that they weren't, you know, for revolution with a capital R or insurrection. I was wondering if you could give us some hints why that might be. And also, I was wondering in the case about the Panama Canal, if you said that, you know, it was this important project for the U.S. imperial ambitions, and I was wondering if people went to Panama in order to kind of sabotage that, or at least when they were there, their whole activity was just outward-looking, or they did try to organize within the workers in order to stop the construction of the canal and whatnot.
Okay, very quickly. There's an evolution that occurs. Initially, the Yiddish anarchists are all blood and fire, Johann Most-inspired propaganda by the Deists. And they're all for, you know, insurrectionary violence, and, you know, Alexander Berkman comes out of that tradition. In the 1890s, this changes. Saul Yanofsky is a key figure in this. While he's editing that London paper, there's an instance in Spain where some bombs are thrown in the theater that kill a bunch of bystanders, and that turns him against propaganda by the deed in particular, and he starts arguing against the argument that anarchism needs to be a mass movement, it can't be something on individual acts, and so forth. He actually gets kicked out of his editorship because of that. But he comes back to the U.S., sort of, and more, there's a disillusionment, in particular with the propaganda by the deed, but that sort of transfers into a more general disillusionment with the idea of a sort of impending revolution. That doesn't seem a possibility, it doesn't seem like it's around the corner. And so the emphasis on building a mass movement, and again, the sort of change in consciousness as a necessary prerequisite.
In the Panama Canal, the question is about whether the anarchists ever go in to try and maybe sabotage the canal, or were they just completely outward-looking? I have to say they're mainly outward-looking. The only reports I could find, the anarchists never publicly talk about using violence in the canal. Never talk about it publicly anyway. There's any kind of a record of that. Now, in late 1911, the ICC, which is the U.S. body that was running the canal, they were getting reports from informants that there was a plot to blow up the locks.
Nothing seems to have come of it. I can't find any reports that any arrests were made, and it seems like the government, the ICC, just sort of said that there's really nothing here.
Yeah. Back here.
Okay, this is going to have to be the last question because the organizers are signaling for us to wrap up. So,
first question is for Kurt. It's in regards to, do you have any theories? I'm sure with research, that there's a bit of an obsession that happened, but do you have any theories on what happened to Rodriguez? Did he happen to show up in the same time that maybe... that ISIL took over the project or something?
I have theories. I have yet to find anything to back them up. My favorite theory, well, one is he took the money and just fled, because then he had a history of running when things got tight. Fled from Argentina during strikes, fled Cuba when things got rough, leaves Panama when things aren't going right. My favorite theory, just before he left, he published an announcement saying maybe what we need to do is just run away, right? And found and create our own libertarian colony.
With seed money.
With seed money, exactly. With seed money, obviously. That's my favorite theory, but I have zero to substantiate.
Thank you all very much. We need to proceed to that.
I'm just so bad because you saw me back.